Right, so that's the primary reason why I came here, and depending on how things go, how many times I get interrupted by peers or by anybody else, there's a possibility of me saying a few things about uranium reasoning from silicon too as well, that John Mydoff didn't talk about. So I'll start off with, main disk data, where is this? Whoops. Sorry about that. I have no idea what that was about. Right, there we go. I just added this thing on this morning, just to lighten things up. I don't know if you can see that very clearly, but this is just a picture of a 100 Tesla shot on a single turn capability that's currently under development at Los Alamos. So these are all bits of copper flying out when the coil explodes, about has a bore of about 10 millimeters or so, and that's better. And then there's this containment box. So the coil is essentially coming out through the holes around the edges of this box.
That was testing and destruction.
That was, well, no, in fact, it blows up every time. It's impossible to confine 100 Tesla, in something the size of 10 millimeters of any known material. So it will blow up no matter what. So that's not really related to the talk.
But is 10 picoseconds long enough to do a measurement?
It's actually 5 microseconds.
Oh, sorry.
That's also very, very short. I mean, we're talking about something of order 10 to the 4, 10 to the 5, Tesla per second. So that's a huge rate of change of field. Certainly eddy current heating becomes a big problem if you're dealing with metals. But that doesn't really have much to do with cerium indium 3, or it could have potentially, although I'm not quite ready for that yet. So I actually gave you the wrong title. My title doesn't actually have the word hotspots on it. I don't know why that is, but but anyway, it's got hotspots in it. The talk does have. These are the people that are involved in this. Marcelo Jaime is also at Los Alamos. Alejandro Sulenek, he's a postdoc who's recently been getting involved in doing measurements in cerium indium 3. And then Takao Ibahara is the person who grew the samples in Japan. So he has come out to Los Alamos numerous times as a user over the years, and each time he's come with better cerium indium 3 samples. And these are sponsoring organizations. National Science Foundations is Florida State, essentially, because I'm from the Magnet Lab and it's partly funded by Florida State. And this is a logo for the National High Magnetic Field Lab.
Excuse me, somebody from the University of Florida, I have to say, it's the State of Florida, not Florida State.
Sorry, yes, yeah, State of Florida, I always make that mistake. Yeah, it's not the first time I've been told that, actually. I'm always getting that wrong. I don't know why.
Is that really a problem, filling off the edge there?
Yeah, why is that?
You've got the resolution on.
Resolution? Hold on a second.
Detect displays.
Yeah, I did that earlier, but when I came downstairs, where's the control panel? It's usually a thing to arrange.
You have to mirror your display.
Right. Well, I was just thinking of redoing that. Hello, I've lost the mouse. It's on that screen. That's why. Okay. I'll try that again, and then somewhere there was a panel to. Have I messed this up? Yeah, probably. The trouble is,
Yeah, there was another window there a second ago. I don't know what happened to it. Sorry about this. We just close it a second and then open that. There we go. Move it in. Right. Try different combinations and see if it changes. Does anyone have any bright ideas? What? Well, I can try it, see what happens.
Okay.
Is that better?
No.
That's better, yeah. Adjusting.
Yeah, it got more of the screen there.
Yeah, that's better. So, okay, so now let's try and proceed. Ah, that's better, right, excellent. Take a drink after it. So where was I? Right, okay, now back to the subject of antiferromagnetic quantum criticality. So, of course, I have to start off with an introduction, and even though you don't really need that, since you're all experts on this subject. Essentially, there is the question of pressure-induced antiferromagnetic quantum criticality being perhaps a generic property of strongly correlated F-electron systems. We can use the term heavy fermion systems if we like. Of course, there are these well-known examples, and if you can see it very well, cerium-indium 3, cerium-palladium 2, silicon 2, these are some of the two first well-known examples. And one of the goals is to try to understand a potential link between antiferromagnetic quantum criticality and the creation of new phases, e.g. unconventional forms of superconductivity, as you have down here in these two systems.
Is it antiferromagnetic on the left and paramagnetic, is that right?
Yeah, it would be paramagnetic up here, presumably.
Sorry, go ahead.
It's paramagnetic up here, yes.
And to the left it's antiferromagnetic?
Yes, yes.
And then it'll go on with superconductivity.
This is superconductivity, yeah. This is from the Cambridge group published back in the late 90s or something. Not surprisingly, this requires a microscopic model of the quantum critical point itself. Now, that's not my job, of course, because I'm an experimentalist.
In this case, there actually is no quantum critical point, right? Because the superconductivity intervenes.
Right. Right, right, right. So you either have a quantum critical point or it doesn't exist because you get a new phase. Right, but when you're at higher temperatures, you see, before the new phase forms, you see some of the some physical properties which are characteristic of the quantum critical point existing at lower temperatures. And then that goes away when the new phase forms.
So you don't have coexistence of antiferromagnetism and superconductivity, or you don't know?
That's an interesting point. It's very hard to prove at very high pressures.
Mm-hmm.
About these particular systems, I would say I don't think it's actually that's actually really been properly cleared up.
So we don't know whether this line that comes down the Yale temperature line basically cuts through the dome, or whether it basically is pushed away to the left of the superconducting dome.
Right. Well,
but then we basically don't know whether there's a quantum critical point or not.
Right. I mean, basically what happens is essentially what you see is, this is not my experiment, but essentially what you see is that the evidence for the phase transition, the antiferromagnetic phase transition sort of peters out. It becomes very hard to detect as you get closer down to low temperatures. But nonetheless, when you go to higher temperatures, you see things like linear resistivity, you see a divergence in specificities and stuff like that. I'm just going through. So these are just the typical sort of generic things that everyone's familiar with, where you have the antiferromagnetic metal, you have possibility of a heavy fermi liquid state up here, and then you would see non-fermi liquid behavior. And both of these systems kind of kind of, in some certain ways, consistent with this sort of general picture. Of course, inside the antiferromagnetic phase, exactly whether you would see a T-squared coefficient or something else, of course, is not exactly clear, because, of course, you have the spin waves and things which could potentially make things a little bit more complicated. I'm going to talk about that.
Is this antiferromagnetic phase just the normal antiferromagnetic?
Presumably.
The huge moments?
Sorry?
The moments are close to free moments?
Yes. In this, in cerium-indium 3, that's the case. That's not necessarily always the case, I don't think, but in cerium-indium 3, that's certainly...
So you're discussing cerium-indium 3.
So I'm going to be... I'm going to be primarily discussing cerium-indium 3. And just part of the introduction, just to discuss what the general thermodynamics would be. Perhaps you would see characteristics in the Sommerfeld coefficient or in the susceptibility, which shows some sort of divergent behavior. And actually, at this point here, of course, you have a Fermi liquid, not at this point, so in this region here, and then you would have a crossover to something else, which is referred to as a non-fermi liquid at higher temperatures. And you can see that by way of a derivative of the resistivity, although this is not actually cerium-indium 3, this is just a generic example. As I was saying just a few seconds ago, of course, in the antiferromagnetic phase, of course, one has spin waves as well, because it is an antiferromagnet. So then there is the question of what is the antiferromagnetic order parameter, how it is, what does it form with respect to, and the common picture which seems to be very much debated in the literature these days is, of course, the heavy Fermi liquid, which is essentially resulting from Kondo screening of lattice of F moments, and one has these composite particles and a Fermi surface that appears to accommodate the F electrons. And this is often referred to as the large Fermi surface model or picture. And one can form, for example, antiferromagnetism due to something like a spin density wave. And in that particular case, of course, one has the original Fermi surface. It's essentially the same Fermi surface which becomes reconstructed due to some sort of nesting vector. And so one goes from having something like this to something like this. One will have a very clear mapping between this and this, which should be possible to see in an experiment. And so one essentially here still has the heavy Fermi liquid, it's just been reconstructed. The alternative picture is, of course, that in what is sometimes referred to as a strong coupling limit, is that these composite particles break up, and the one essentially goes to regular conduction electrons and F electrons, which appear to be decoupled from the Fermi surface. And this is quite often referred to as the small Fermi surface in that case, because there are no F electrons contributing to the Fermi surface. And then one might then have something which looks like a radical change in the Fermi surface topology. So there's no obvious relation between these two Fermi surface topologies, unlike this case.
Sorry, could you just say a word again about the first case? That's A and B, is that right?
Mm-hmm.
So the Guyon zone is halved when it goes antiferromagnetic.
Well, it could be halved, or it depends.
That explains the change in the surface.
Well, in this particular simple model, it would be half, but of course, in a three-dimensional crystal, it could be one quarter, or it could be 1/8.
What's the hole in, say, the donut thing?
It's just another bit of Fermi surface. I just wanted to show two sheets of Fermi surface, just to get across the point that if one has a very small bit of Fermi surface, it doesn't get affected by the translation.
Oh, I see. But the big one does, because the
gluon zone. Right, because it intercepts the antiferromagnetic gluon zone boundary. That's the point I was trying to get across to.
And why, I mean, in the second case, when you have the onset of interferomagnetism, you still have the gluon.
Yes, you would, yes. But actually, conveniently, I actually draw this thing inside the antiferromagnetic Brillouin zone, so you wouldn't actually be able to see the Bragg reflection. But that is an important point. You will still get Bragg reflection even in this case. Although it's different, because it's not from a spin density wave. Now I come on to quantum oscillations, and essentially what's so wonderful about doing quantum oscillations or quantum oscillation experiments is, of course, that what you measure is directly related to the Fermi surface topology. And when you measure a frequency in 1 over B, where B is a magnetic field, one can relate in a very precise manner the frequency to the cross-sectional area of the Fermi surface. Just to show an example, this is actually pertains to a poster I saw last year at SCES, and I haven't seen the paper come out yet in the press. I don't know what's happened to it, but it's actually from the Yanuki group. And just as an example, cerium, rhodium, indium 5, one has a Fermi surface with some sort of topology like this. Under pressure, it becomes a superconductor, and at a slightly higher pressure, so you get a radical transformation in the Fermi surface to something which looks like cerium cobalt indium 5. And of course, it's questionable whether or not this system really has a quantum critical point or not. Although it does show this sort of, I would say, localized itinerant type transition as a function of pressure. So that's still yet to be published. I'm not quite sure what's happening with that paper. So there are a number of interesting questions, and that is, of course, one.
Is it lanthanum rhodium indium 5?
Yeah, I think
the point that it looks like lanthanum rhodium indium 5.
Well, actually, this is actually the lanthanum rhodium indium 5. I've measured cerium rhodium indium 5, and it's exactly the same.
Okay.
So there's no difference. You can't distinguish those two. In fact, you can make substitutions of lanthanum and cerium at any concentration, and you always see the same Fermi surface.
Oh.
And we've done those experiments. So one of the issues is, of course, whether it's a real quantum critical point. Does the nail temperature drop continuously to zero as you approach the critical pressure? And I'm not sure whether that's true or not. Of course, pressure experiments, these very high pressure experiments, are also very difficult. And of course, another issue is, of course, these types of experiments are done in a magnetic field, 10 tesla. You need something of order 10 tesla to do a quantum oscillation experiment. And of course, what is the effect of the magnetic field on that quantum critical point? That's a question which, of course, I haven't seen addressed in many of the papers that have been coming out on this sort of subject. So we know that magnetic fields can tune quantum critical points, or potentially tune quantum critical points. Of course, you have this very well-known example, ytterbium, rhodium, silicon 2. I actually changed the color because I thought you probably got tired of seeing the blue and orange. So, so I went to blue and yellow. And of course, just to highlight a recent paper which came out from the same group, they do claim to see a change in the Hall coefficient, which I would say yields kind of indirect evidence for a change in the Fermi surface topology. It's very indirect, of course. Trying to relate a Hall effect to a Fermi surface is certainly by no means a trivial translation. And of course, the best thing that one could do is hope to see quantum oscillations, although these fields are very low in this particular system. That would be a very difficult experiment for that material. So another advantage of high magnetic fields is, of course, that one can sweep a magnetic field in a continuous fashion, and it's reversible, it's controllable, and unlike pressure, of course, I would say with pressure, by contrast, you cannot sweep the pressure. You have to go to a fixed pressure and then do temperature sweeps or sweep something else. And of course, the inability to do a pressure sweep, of course, makes it very hard to identify things like first order phase transitions, etc., etc. It also makes experiments a lot more difficult. Just coming back to ceruminium 3, of course, that system itself has its own complications, and in fact there was a recent publication that came out last year from the Inuki group. This is the original, I guess, the original model of Mathieu and Guillandrit, etc. And essentially they were proposing the superconductivity to be created as a result of spin fluctuations at what might be a quantum critical point here. And of course, the Japanese group were claiming that there may be some additional phases down here, perhaps some phase coexistence or something like this. And I would say this is certainly something with an area which needs more attention. And maybe even showing a very low temperature region where they have some very complex behavior down here. Don't really want to go into that though. So there is a possibility of there being a first order phase transition in ceruminium 3, or, you know, and the question is that a product of the quantum criticality itself, or is it just simply that the thing is just not a quantum critical point at all? You know, that's an interesting question. And the Hassel-Melfin experiments in ceruminium 3 have been done under pressure, but I would say the older measurements, which were actually this conference was a couple of years ago, although it's only just come out in press, haven't really given a very clear indication of what's happening with the Fermi surface. And so just by doing experiments with the function of pressure alone has not yielded a very clear understanding of this material. And of course, once again, of course, these experiments are done in a magnetic field of order 10 Tesla, and the effect of the magnetic field on the quantum critical point, or I would say perhaps the putative quantum critical point, hasn't been addressed in any of this work. So coming to continuing with ceruminium 3, it's essentially just showing some results of the specific heat as a function of temperature at various different magnetic fields. And 0 Tesla is this one here. We have 15 Tesla, 35 Tesla, and 45 Tesla in the hybrid. You can see that this thing has a very well-defined form that is being suppressed by the magnetic field. And so one has qualitatively a similar effect of the magnetic field as in ytterbium rhodium to silicon 2. It doesn't mean that the same things are precisely the same. Remember, there's a 100 times difference in the fields, and roughly 100 times difference in the nail temperatures in these systems.
Were these measured in a static DC field?
Yes. Yeah, so in the 45T hybrid magnet in Tallahassee, it's possible to sit at 45 Tesla for a couple of hours if necessary. And then, of course, the cooling water starts to heat up and
Are there experimental reasons why they get more bumps and wriggles in the heat curves at high fields?
This one here, because the experiment had to be done in a shorter time.
Okay.
And so it's just more noise.
Okay.
It's a time constrained issue. So as you go to much shorter times, the signal to noise of your experiment will get worse.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just an inevitable consequence of very high magnetic field experiments. It's also a little bit more noisy because you've got these huge currents circulating in the magnet. There's a lot of the whole thing's vibrating while you're doing the experiment. And it has these huge stray fields, so you have to have these cables going, 10 or 20 meters to your electronics. If you put the electronics too close to the magnet, then it stops functioning because of, I guess, switches and things inside the electronics will just become stuck, etc. There's generally, of course, 45 Tesla is more or less the limit in field what you can go to do specific heat measurements. There have been experiments done in the 60 Tesla long pulse magnet in Los Alamos before, where it was possible to have 100 milliseconds at 60 Tesla. And a couple of materials were studied in that magnet. Although it's currently being rebuilt because it blew up a few years ago. We hope to be able to use that at some point in the future. And ceruminium 3 would certainly be an interesting candidate. Magnetization, on the other hand, can be quite easily measured in magnetic fields above 45 Tesla using our short pulse magnets. And he's just showing an example of the magnetization of cerium and indium 3 as a function of field. So I don't know whether you want me to show you this or not. This is just a very crude view graph just showing the experimental technique. So here's a pair of counterwound coils, which were essentially connected to what amounts to a voltmeter. It was actually a digital a digitizer, which records data at like a megahertz or higher. And we can repeat experiments with or without the sample present. And essentially by taking the difference between those the experiment without the sample and the experiment with the sample, one can obtain the voltage just due to the sample and then analyze the signal accordingly. With specific heat experiments in large fields, the probe essentially has to be made out of plastic. And so this is actually G10 here. And then this is actually a silicon wafer on which the sample and heater and thermometers are mounted. And so this is what you would need to do an experiment in a 45 Tesla hybrid magnet or something, or certainly you would need to have something like this to be a 60 Tesla long pulse magnet. So coming back to data again, so this is cerium indium 3. So one of the experiments, the data I just showed you before, was magnetization. And if one looks at the magnetization of cerium indium 3 as a function of temperature, in fact, to do different temperatures, you have to do pulses at different temperatures. And so you can only sweep the field in a pulse magnet. And if you plot 1 over chi, you see that you get something which looks like a kink at T nail. Obviously, the data is noisier than what you would get in a superconducting magnet. It is a pulse magnet, and the total length of the pulse is maybe 10, 20 milliseconds. And this is actually showing data. This is actually 0 Tesla, and then these are corresponding lines at 5 Tesla increments up to about, I think, 55 in this particular case. And one can see that this kink, which you can represent with a very crude elbow function, is being shifted gradually to lower temperatures as one cranks up the field.
You don't really mean it changes sign, do you?
I'm sorry, what's that?
There's a 0 on the vertical axis.
No, it doesn't change signs. It's just, it's just the way it's been plotted. They've been shifted, in fact.
Yes.
And that's what I haven't, yeah, they've been vertically shifted for clarity, yeah. Yeah, sorry about that. Yeah. Whoops, that was very brief. So if one looks at the specific heat data, this is actually the lower field specific heat data, one sees a sort of more or less parabolic dependence on the magnetic field. And if one takes then the specific heat data points, which are these things with very large error bars, one can see that it approximately reproduces this parabolic dependence up to as high as we can measure. And so there is the possibility of there being some a critical field somewhere in this sort of region up here. I don't know if you can see that. But there's obviously some degree of error in that critical field.
So what is the difference between the squares, the crosses, and the circles?
Yeah, I'm sorry. The crosses correspond to the pressure measurements. Okay, so this is from the Cambridge group. I've just essentially plotted their data. It's actually got a different exponent if you plot P minus PC. Mm-hmm. And the squares are specific heat, the dark circles are from the susceptibility kink. And here I've actually used 1 minus, this is actually B on BC squared. And I use the field squared because, of course, this thing will can't have a slope at T. That's B equals 0. That's the simple here. Sorry?
The dots don't look very curved. They look more linear, don't they?
These dots?
Yes.
This is not a fit to those dots. Essentially, this line is a product of a parabolic extrapolation of the specific heat data.
Yeah.
And then what I've done is put these susceptibility data points on top of that. and they more or less line up. So the data is not actually fitted to this, to these points. If one, sorry about the clarity of this thing, it didn't look very clear. But so there is, of course, the possibility of there being some notional line of quantum critical points that extends from the pressure axis to the field axis. One, of course, this has already been fairly well established, although whether this is truly a quantum critical point or whether it's first order phase transition in this region or not, of course, is another topic of debate. But up here, of course, one has the possibility of there also being a quantum critical point and in at all, at various ranges of pressure and magnetic field, one has a possibility of exploring this line. So the actual functional form of P on B, of course, is completely unknown at present. So what I draw on there is essentially just the line.
M versus T at various fields.
I'm sorry, what's that?
You have data for magnetization versus field at various temperatures.
Yes.
You see a because the scope is changing. Do you see a metamagnetization?
No, there's no sharp transition. Essentially, I did show that earlier. Essentially, the magnetization, I don't know if you want me to go back to it or not, but the magnetization is essentially, you see it
keeps going up.
Yeah, gradually it is rolling over. It's gradually approaching saturation. There's no metamagnetic transition, as far as I can tell. Well, certainly not below 65 Tesla. And so it's nice to compare the two sets of data that have been taken so far. Of course, this corresponds to the Anuki de Haslam Alpen experiments. We have magnetic field here. We have pressure. This is around 10 Tesla or so. So essentially, they probe this region of phase space with the de Haslam Alpen experiments, whereas what I'm doing in pulse magnetic fields is going very low, very close. Well, of course, I'm at ambient pressure. So I'm going very close to this part of the phase diagram, purely increasing the magnetic field. So it's accessing a somewhat different part of the phase diagram. And I'm actually just showing here some results of specific heat measurements and transport measurements just done at very low magnetic fields in cerium indium 3. And one can measure, try to estimate what the gamma, the Sommerfeld coefficient is. And it seems to be, first of all, it increases and goes down, but I wouldn't like to claim that this, the actual determination of gamma here is very reliable. In fact, if you go to very low temperatures in cerium indium 3 below the nail temperature, the resistivity actually seems to be cubic. And I think that's a product of the spin waves. Although there is no, I haven't been able to find any paper which can predict that sort of cubic resistivity due to spin waves. I found all kinds of other power laws, T to the fifth, T quartic, or maybe three halves or something, but I haven't managed to find any prediction that it should be cubic, but that's just what it is. And it's quite likely also that specific heat measurements would be affected by spin waves. And so measurements of the A coefficient, sorry, this is a small a here. It's actually a bit, this A is supposed to be the same as this A. So essentially the measurements of the transport and of the specific heat are inconclusive. Whereas, of course, the Haslam Alpen experiments are purely, I would say, the amplitude of the quantum oscillations is a direct measure of the effective mass, which is not affected by spin waves, but is affected by fluctuations. And one has the potential to explore what's happening with the fluctuations as one increases the magnetic field and gets closer to this critical field. So one of the interesting observations in cerium indium 3 is that one, of course, one can do a orientation dependence, and the main frequency in this material has a frequency of around 3,000 Tesla. It's just a little bit smaller than the antiferromagnetic baryon zone, and if one sweeps the orientation, one sees that the mass goes up and down. So there's like large regions where the mass is very small, and then one sees regions where the mass becomes very high and goes. So this is about 2 here, up here it's about 10 or 12.
Do you know what the actual Fermi surface is in the material? Do you have enough to Hausdorff and Alpha data?
At least some bits of it, yes.
Sorry, could you just remind me, how do you get AKM star from the Hausdorff and Alpha?
To get M star, you would look at the temperature dependence of the oscillations. I'm sure I do actually have that data somewhere on this computer. I mean, I can show you that at some point if you want to. And then there's a very, I can sketch it on the board if you want. There's a very well-defined functional form, and that is you find that the amplitude, the function of temperature, goes as x on sine h of x, and x is like, it's like 2 pi squared e temperature effective mass, and then there's like a h bar, sorry, I missed something there. There's a, that's the next 3. H bar, k, 3. So essentially this x term is proportional to the temperature divided by the magnetic field, and then you've got the effective mass in there, and that provides a very direct measure of the effective mass, gives you very good temperature. And this is well established in all materials.
Thanks.
How do you know this effective mass measured from the last Planck effect, the same effective mass in other measurements? Or do they keep 2 different effective masses?
Which other measurements?
Like transport.
Well, of course, the transport. Well, of course, you're talking about the Kadowski-Woods ratio. But of course, I don't know if there is a precise theory for the Kadowski-Woods ratio. But it's an empirical rule.
Specific heat, at least according to the standard.
But the specific heat should be directly related to M star. But of course,
I always think there are 2 different M star. One is the Planck effect to make a different M star.
It shouldn't be.
What?
Different from what?
Other than like transport.
Well,
it doesn't measure M star.
No, forget transport.
So there's a question is whether the available Hausdorff and Alpha data does or does not saturate the specific heat coefficient, or maybe you haven't seen enough of the Fermi circle.
Well, in order to map the Hausdorff and Alpha experiments to specific heat measurements, one would have to do a full angular study, see, make sure one sees every single section of Fermi surface, and then integrate over the surface area.
But here's the general question.
And then you have to integrate over the
general question.
Right, right.
Does the half an hour can measure the same mass as you get in specific heat? And generally speaking, the answer is yes, it
yes,
does.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. There should be a direct one-to-one correspondence between the 2, although it's difficult to prove.
An average. That's right. Yes.
It's very easy to prove that in weakly correlated systems, but in a lot of these heavy fermion materials where one has very complicated Fermi surfaces, it's very difficult to see all of the Fermi surface, and then it's very difficult to do the integration if you've got a complicated shape.
Is there a single example where people have done the whole program?
Well, I would say the best example I know of, and it's one that I've worked on, is cerium hexafluoride, where one has these spherical bits of Fermi surface which account for the entire density of states. Well, that's got a very complicated Fermi surface topology.
Yeah, well,
they might be able to show that it's a consistency, but I don't think they can really prove that they. I mean, I don't think it's possible to relate what's been, the essential different. Regions of Fermi surfaces to perform that sort of integration to prove that there's a direct correlation. There's very few cases where you can actually prove that directly. And I would say cerium ruthenium 2 sitting into it's probably not possible to do that. I mean, there's no reason why it shouldn't be true, but I would say to do the measurement would be and to try to account for the entire Fermi surface and relate that to the specific heat, I would think would be nearly impossible in cerium 270, because one has a very complicated shape.
for the firm.
I'm not sure about that. I mean, Uranium Platinum 3, the comparison is identical and a very complicated Fermi surface.
Right.
I think the question in serum routines in silicon too is because of exchange polarization of the surface, that leads to some complications. But
Well, you mentioned Uranium Platinum 3, but even there I don't think it's possible. I mean, one also has a complicated Fermi surface. I mean, you can measure.
If you map the whole thing out, there's no problem.
But no one's done that.
Huh?
No one's done that.
Sure they have.
Well, yes. Mm-hmm. I would say the angular dependence of the frequencies and the effective masses to some extent have been measured. But no one's has been able to go and, you know, integrate over the surface area and show that all of the specific heat is accounted for by the Fermi surface. No one's done that. As far as I know.
No one's published that, but it's been done. So would you
continue? Well, I'd be very interested to see that. But I'm surprised. But you know, it's quite often the case that there are many sections of Fermi surfaces which are just not seen because the masses are too large.
Are you going to show us some temperature dependence of M star?
No temperature dependence. M star is not expected to be temperature dependent generally. Although there was a talk about that yesterday, that if you go to most metals, I would say it's not a generic observation. Sorry? Well, I haven't seen any one show very clear indication that there's a temperature dependent mass. So if you can find an example, then and show that to me, then. I'll be happy to see it.
Linear, if you have a linear T resistance, for instance, you know your effective mass has to be temperature dependent.
Exactly.
Yeah, but that's not a de Hausdorff experiment. That's a resistivity measurement.
But if you had
a linear resistivity, it's probably a non-Fermi liquid, so you wouldn't even be able to measure the effective mass of the quantum oscillation experiment.
It's not a Fermi liquid.
You can only measure.
No, this is the point. People have calculated the Haas and Alpha signal for Marshall Fermi liquid. There are deviations from Marshall's Kosovich formula.
Yeah, that's true. But of course, what one finds is that one has a low temperature limit to the effective mass. But I don't think it's ever been experimentally verified. Has it? Not to my knowledge.
No one's got a Haas and Alpha signal on the material
Right. So there's still sort of, so what I said remains true. I mean, there's no experimental verification of a temperature dependent mass.
No, the question is, you just said you don't have a non-Fermi resistivity anyway, right? You have a TQ resistance
inside the antiferromagnetic phase of ceruminium 3, yes. And there's no reason, I mean, I don't have any good reason for expecting the effective mass to be temperature dependent. And the data don't seem to show that it's temperature dependent.
It's just a normal Fermi liquid where particles scatter on spin waves.
Yes. Yeah. So, of course, seeing an effective mass which varies as a function of orientation, which varies over the Fermi surface, is of course a direct consequence of many body effects. One could not have that in a free electron metal. If you were to go to a free electron metal, there should be a one-to-one correspondence between the effective mass and the cross-section for a given sheet of Fermi surface. And that's particularly obvious if one thinks of a parabolic band, which is a spherical Fermi surface, the direct one-to-one correspondence between the mass and the cross-section.
And is the area the cross-sectional?
Sorry?
F is the cross-sectional
yes.
area?
Yes.
But your formula to apply, to actually get M star, is, I mean, you assume that doesn't have any many body effects in it, right?
In fact, this form has been proven to survive, like the electron phonon interaction, spin fluctuations, and various other things.
Okay.
You end up with the same functional form, and this has been shown. One of the persons who's an expert on that subject is Alan Wasserman, who's in Oregon State.
One of the experts is sitting in the front row.
Right, well, yeah, that's probably true, but... So where was I? Coming back to this again. So the only way to explain this sort of variation is the existence of hotspots on the Fermi surface, and that is, as long as the orbit doesn't cross through these hotspot regions, one sees a very light effective mass, and as soon as it intersects one of these spots, one has a very large effective mass. And when you make an effective mass measurement with a de Hasselmalton experiment, what you're essentially measuring is some sort of orbital average. One can do this sort of integration around the orbit in k-space.
So again, the surface is thought to be spherical.
Yes, well, it's known to be spherical. It's not just thought to be spherical.
Okay, so it's known to be spherical. So this is really a mass effect and not...
Yes, purely the mass. Yes.
So you have spots on a spherical Fermi case, it's not light.
Yeah, there's spots in this particular case. And I will discuss why they're spots later on. So if one takes this effective mass of 12 and looks at the approximate size of these hotspots by measuring the width here, one can infer that in the regions in between the mass is 2, and on these hotspots at around 10 tesla, the mass must be about 30.
I'm trying to be devil's advocate here. Imagine you had necks on the Fermi surface.
Necks,
with these,
right.
With these red spots right at you, have magnetic breakdown across these necks. I mean,
right, oh, you're coming to the later section of my talk here. Right, so...
Can you rule out some
weird thing like this going on?
Well, magnetic breakdown is a very well-studied phenomena in metals. And when that occurs, you do not have an enhancement of the mass. It's very simple.
So what is this weird phenomenon?
No, I'm just trying to, you know, the point is whether something could go on with the de Hasselmalton amplitude.
Right.
And it could be is if you had some, imagine necks coming out of the Fermi surface there.
What coming out?
Necks. Just like you have in copper or something. And of course,
right.
When the thing went across there, you get an open orbit.
What
yes.
Is
yeah. Well, I mean, okay, one can...
I asked him my mirror, I didn't understand.
What he means is something like this, okay? So you have a Fermi surface with the quantum particles going around the Fermi surface, and you have this neck, okay?
Oh, yeah.
And in a very strong magnetic field, the thing can tunnel through these necks. It's called magnetic breakdown. And when that happens, you do not get an enhancement of the mass at that point.
But there's an amplitude effect associated.
No, there's no amplitude effect that's been reported in any other material, as far as I know.
Okay.
So essentially, if this was a mass of 2 here, and you were to have breakdown here, you would continue to see a mass of 2 for the entire orbit.
And if there is a hotspot, why do you see?
Well, this is just an experimental observation. We have these hotspots.
Observation is that you say that a bigger mass.
Yeah. Yes,
yeah.
And I'm calling
associating this with this.
The angular dependence is interpreted in terms of these hotspots.
Well, the reason why I'm calling them hotspots is because the effective mass is a function of whatever fluctuations you have in the system. And since the effective mass is varying over the Fermi surface, that's a direct proof of there being fluctuations present. And the orientation dependence is showing us that these fluctuations are concentrated at these regions on the Fermi surface, which I'm calling hotspots.
So the M star is going from a Dingle plot, is that right?
No, that's the scattering rate that you get from a Dingle plot. The effective mass is got by plotting this as a function of temperature and doing a fit.
There's an amplitude factor involved, right, which involves a curvature of the Fermi surface.
No, it doesn't involve the curvature. It purely involves the cyclotron energy, which is the spacing between lambda levels. There is the curvature of the Fermi surface does feed into the amplitude, but it doesn't have a temperature dependence.
Okay, this is technical. We can talk about it later. But.
So, right. So, if you were to undo this orbital integration, you would see that the hotspot mass is around 30, and everywhere else it's around 2. So the interesting thing is, of course, when one does a very high magnetic field experiment using pulsed magnetic fields, one can measure how this effective mass evolves as a function of field. And what one sees, if one puts the magnetic field along the 100 axis, that's where the orbit is traveling around this part of the Fermi surface where there's no hot spots, that the mass doesn't really do anything as a function of field. Certainly smaller than the error bars. Whereas if one looks at an orientation where the orbit cuts or just barely intersects these hot spots, one sees at very low magnetic fields a mass of around 3, and then one sees this go up. One sees this increase as a function of magnetic field.
I'd like to understand. So you associate each point in k-space with mass.
Then yes.
You arbitrarily draw red circles.
Yes.
And say, I weight my line integral.
Yes.
In some way, it goes from 2 to 30, and then there's a gradual change in this region, and then you.
Well, I mean, whether it's a gradual change or an abrupt change,
okay.
You
do some numerical.
Right.
Integration for the various paths.
For an orbit.
In the orbits?
Yes. Okay. Well, it's essentially a cycle of an orbit, so it's a time. You're integrating the time around the orbit, and so what happens is the quasiparticles are moving very quickly in these open areas, and they become very slow in these areas, these hotspot regions.
But and when you know where the hotspots are in momentum space?
Yes.
You know that you've got a pi order in this system.
Yes.
So that's
yeah.
An additional piece of information.
Yeah, I can tell you one thing, that the location of these hotspots is not a surprise in this particular case, as will become clear later. The way that we're able to determine the location is by looking at the orientation dependence, just from the symmetry.
Sorry, I'm confusing. This is all now in the antiferromagnetic state.
Yes.
Okay.
This is all inside the antiferromagnetic phase, even this data point here, presumably. So one can infer, just by looking at the proportionalities, that the mass on the hotspots could perhaps go up to something of order 200, 250.
Does the signal just die out on the 111 orbit, sir?
Well, of course, when one does a de Hasselhoffian experiment, the amplitude is proportional to this factor, mm-hmm. which has got the mass in it. And if the mass becomes very heavy, mm-hmm. then you need a lower temperature, and in pulsed magnetic fields, the lowest temperature we can go to is about 450 millikelvin. And so when the mass reaches this sort of value here, the signal sort of peters out high fields. So just a sort of additional point to make, and of course one can also orient the field along the 110 direction. And when one does that, the orbit goes directly through these hot spots. And that's where, at 10 Tesla, you get a mass of around 12. And that's too heavy to see in the pulse magnet experiment. So, I mean, I don't have any direct proof showing that that one increases as a function of field, but presumably it would. That would be nice to confirm, of course. But that would require the use of a dilution fridge. And just another comment, of course, there are some other bits of Fermi surface of cerium indium 3 which are much smaller and have masses in the range of 20 to 50. These are unobservable in the pulse magnetic field experiments. So there's some much smaller pockets, which I cannot see in this particular experiment.
The 110 orbits are seen in the low field experiments.
Yes, in some people see them, yes.
So the 110, we can get to the second thing.
Yes, this has been seen at 12 Tesla, between 10 and 15 Tesla, or maybe 20 Tesla, and it's around 12.
Okay.
Right.
Oh,
maybe
I was just going to put it on this plot.
That was on the.
That's an old publication. I mean, that was published like within the last 10 years sometime.
And does that fit with your picture, with your model, when you go down to low fields?
Well, yes. I mean, presumably. Can you expand on that question? What exactly do you mean by fit?
You have a fit for the
right
for the directional dependent mass
right.
that fits your other two directions.
Right.
When you now apply that to the 110 direction, you should be able to predict what's measured at least at 15 Tesla to that orbit.
Right. I haven't tried to estimate what this mass of course is 12. I haven't tried to estimate what it would be at 40 Tesla. But I would guess, well, the hotspot map, I mean, you can integrate it. It'll, I mean, I can do this, I can work it out for you here if you want.
On but, the actual hotspots, I mean, whether they.
Yes.
Well, so it could affect, it's interesting to know whether it would correspond or not.
I mean, right. This is supposed to be a magnetic hotspot effect. The system's in the orbital phase.
Yes.
No varied region should have been destroyed already, right?
These are the electrons order, right? And these are the premise of the conduction.
Yes. So
it's twofold, first of all. Otherwise, you would have, if you had only had one species of electrons that order, the whole thing should be hot.
Or gone.
Depending on the ordering.
No, not necessarily. I mean, you can have a weak SDW, right? And you still have hole pockets in there.
Continue.
I'm not going to say that.
I mean, if you remove the F moments,
yes,
this Fermi sphere accounts for all of the other electrons in the conduction.
Well, of course.
I
will come on to that, but there is Bragg reflection. I mean, the F moments seem to be localized, and I know that they're localized because I've even, it's not published yet, but we have done some compositional studies where you substitute lanthanum with cerium, and the Fermi, this Fermi surface is still present.
So this is the same as the lanthanum in India. Yeah,
this Fermi, I would say the major part of this Fermi surface is from lanthanum indium 3.
But there are no hot spots in lanthanum, I hope.
No. No.
Lanthanum is paramagnetic. It doesn't have a zone fallback in the lanthanum.
No. So there's no hot spots. What you do have are these necks, and I was going to come on to that later on in my presentation. But I was going to compare the two systems.
Can you actually exclude that the C electrons, the conduction electrons, do not show something like an SDW transition?
Well, I mean, if you did have Bragg reflection of the conduction electrons off the F moments, I mean, it will look the same as an SDW, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, it'd be hard to distinguish it. I mean, in both cases, you have Bragg reflection, so.
So you cannot distinguish.
I would say it would. Well, I don't see how. How are we doing for time?
We're up to the 1 hour mark now.
Really?
Yeah.
let's see, which view graph am I on now? Are you joking or what? This is only slide 16. I think there's like 24 or something. Obviously, you won't be able to get onto uranium ruthenium to silicon.
No,
this is that's what you were hoping.
We'll get to that one.
So these are just some empirical, scaling plots. You don't have to take anything meaningful from this. This is just something we did, and essentially, what one can do is to work out an effective Fermi energy. And of course, if the mass is varying over the Fermi surface, and if the frequency or the cross section is not changing, one essentially has a sort of effective Fermi energy which is varying over the Fermi surface. And for a particular orbit, one can define an effective Fermi energy, and we can plot that in a graph. And what we see is that we can fit it with this function G, the same as what we did with the nail temperature, and raise to some exponent. Actually, I forgot to plot what the exponent was here, but I can tell you now it's.
What does it mean effective Fermi energy? I mean,
sorry?
What does it mean effective Fermi energy? I mean, that's the energy up to which we.
Well, effective Fermi energy, and that is, imagine a parabolic orbit intersecting Fermi energy.
Yes.
Then, of course, you would define this as a Fermi energy.
Including lambda levels.
There would be lambda levels and whatever in this thing. Okay. So, what I mean by the effective Fermi, if the mass becomes heavier for some reason due to interactions or whatever, then of course the slope becomes a lot more shallow where it intersects. And of course, what happens at large energies, of course, is anyone's guess. But locally, it looks as if the thing has a smaller Fermi energy. So that's what I mean by the effective Fermi energy.
So that's something like the Fermi velocity which you're scaling.
I would, yeah. I mean, you could relate it to that. I mean, you have the mass, you have the cross section. You could relate it to the Fermi velocity. I just chose Fermi energy because it's just given by this very simple proportionality here, or this very simple.
It might give an estimate of the scale of which the Fermi quantum particles are well defined.
Yeah,
it might.
Right.
If the Fermi are also then it's right. Just the effective mass somehow.
Right. So you could. So the reason I used. Well, I use Fermi energy because it's just simply given by this ratio. Okay, but one could, in principle, extract the Fermi velocity from this, and that's entirely reasonable. But of course, it would be some sort of orbital average of the Fermi velocity. The velocity is actually changing as you go around the orbit. The other thing you can do is you can scale this with the Nail temperature approximately. You can plot everything on a straight line, and the exponent here is roughly 2/3. If one relates Nail temperature to the mass.
So is the alpha prime the same as the alpha in the left figure, 1.54?
Which, this one here.
Is that the same as the alpha in the figure above it?
Here. 1.54? I believe it is supposed to be, yes. Somehow it didn't come out on when I printed it.
What's alpha sub b?
Well, so this is 1.5. Alpha sub b is which one? This one?
Just that's there.
This one here.
Yes.
This is around 1.
That's the one we defined earlier.
For the Nail temperature, it's approximately 1.
Right. Yeah, I have a question. I'm a bit confused now.
I'm getting confused
okay,
as well now.
It's a very generic question. What is the difference on FM? If the Wolf Fermi surface was hot in the sense that n sigma was not 0, and the lifetime of quasi particles is still defined as Fermi surface, would you measure anything? Because you claim you measure the velocity or the band mass, but
yes.
So it's not the same as saying that m sigma is not zero at the Fermi surface and the lifetime of the particle is not zero at Fermi surface. So what we hear by hot theoretically is like the quasi particle is not defined. In that case,
well,
do you ever see the Fermi surface or not?
Well, I mean the very fact that we see the Hassan alpha effect means the quasi particles have to be well defined.
So what do you call
even at the hot spots?
Hot, what do you call hot spots? It's not a point where the imaginary part of the safe energy is non-zero, but it or is big, but it's a point where the velocity is going to zero.
Or it's becoming very small. Yes, obviously it doesn't go to zero, otherwise we wouldn't see the orbit. But
so in a sense, it doesn't have anything to do with what we call a hotspot and cross-spot and spin density wave scenario.
No, I disagree with you. I think in the world formed anti-ferromagnet, you'd have regions of enhanced mass there, but the imaginary part of the sort of energy would surely sort of vanish on the Fermi surface.
Well, if the imaginary part of the energy is vanished on the Fermi surface, he claimed it would change nothing.
No, he didn't claim that. You misheard him. He said he'd see nothing if there was a finite imaginary part to the cell of energy. The fact he sees something means the imaginary part of the cell of energy is very small, right?
At the Fermi energy.
At the Fermi energy.
So one can infer from this magnetic field dependence of the mass, of the Fermi energy, that this thing might become very, very small at somewhere roughly where the critical field is.
Well, can we settle that? How can you know that it's a velocity which is small and not that it's a lifetime of the electron which is big? Which is small.
Well, these things are related to each other, aren't they?
No.
It depends what you mean.
They're not related to each other. I mean, theoretically, you can have one or the other.
What do you mean by lifetime? Do you mean?
Okay, you could have the velocity staying the same and the imaginary part being only in the omega space.
Right.
So, would you measure something?
When you say imaginary space, you're referring to coherent scattering, yes?
Yes.
Right.
The lifetime is very short.
Yes.
And the Fermi surface can be exactly the same, and the lifetime being very short.
Well, very.
So would you want the same signal for the two processes?
This is why I made this comment about when you did a Dingle plot or not.
Right, because, well, the point is that a Dingle plot is related to, non-coherent scattering. And that is scattering from defects and impurities.
No, this is the point. The point is that t equals zero, the only thing you have is impurity scattering.
I'm asking, do you have anything else?
Right.
You have to have there'll be finite temperature corrections on this.
Well, there is always.
So there'll be a breakdown of the Dingle plot. There'll be a deviation from the Dingle plot.
Yeah, I mean, there is also you know, I mean, clearly there is scattering in this system, and that does affect the amplitude of the Hassan-Alpin signal, but generically that's not temperature dependent.
Basically what you're doing, you're assuming there are no imaginary parts of the self-energy, and everything comes from the change in the real part of the self-energy.
Well, I would say, I mean, there have been theories which have attempted to relate the imaginary part to an enhancement of the mass.
I think it would be very helpful if some audience had a course on Hassan
Alpin,
but you don't have time to do that.
I mean, there are works that have been published where one has taken an imaginary self energy and shown that relates to an enhanced mass, and so the enhanced mass that we see at these hotspots could mean that there's a large imaginary contribution to the self-energy at those points.
Wait a second. I think there's a confusion about the terminology of hotspots. When we usually talk about hotspots,
right,
we say there's a lot of scattering between these two points, which means that you have an enhancement in the imaginary part of the self-energy, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
If you are actually an antiferromagnet,
yes,
and you double the Fermi circle, then usually you change the velocity, and therefore you change the mass. But you don't have scattering between your hole pockets, for example.
Real problems with the questions are.
I think this terminology that we usually use in the paramagnetic state doesn't really apply here because we are in the ordered state.
Okay. Yeah, there is a difference. There is a difference, of course.
So I think we should distinguish between changing the velocity of the bands because of antiferromagnetic fluctuations and having a lot of scattering between these hotspots.
Right.
What you have in mind is that you have a lot, that you basically change the velocity of the bands, not necessarily that you have a lot of scattering.
Right. But it's clear that there are fluctuations inside the antiferromagnetic phase.
But they don't usually, if you're a doubling of the unit cell, they usually don't couple to the hotspots anymore. It's called the Adler principle.
Right, well.
But we can discuss that later.
Yes, he did. He told us there was always a tiny dingle temperature, but we're not showing you that stuff. That's just not very interesting. You can distinguish between large amounts of scattering and a renormalization of the mass. I think that's
yes.
simple. You can and you have.
And these are very well established.
Right.
And
so can you summarize or can you, what is the result?
Of what, sorry?
This question.
What experiment shows that this is not due to large capturing rate and is due to an effective mass?
Well, you can have temperature and, of course, a finite lifetime, and then what one sees is that these things, you know, are multiplied by each other. You would have a distinguished term, which is just simply pi over omega c tau, an exponential function. So, scattering from impurities gives you a very well-defined functional form. It's got the cyclone energy in it, so essentially it's better to refer to a mean-free path. And one does not normally expect the mean-free path to depend very strongly on the effective mass. And it certainly doesn't depend on the temperature.
So you don't see that tau changes as you change the orientation, you see that the mass of each...
Well, that hasn't been done. That experiment hasn't been done.
Okay.
But I think
that is an interesting point.
The confusion here is that we're talking about inelastic scattering, okay?
Yes.
And to act, I mean, if you've got a big mass, that means that you've got a lot of renormalizations.
Yes.
Okay? So the inelastic scattering will be large,
yes,
but you have to activate it with temperature. Okay,
right.
And if you're at low temperature, it's not there. These are the real processes, and you're talking the effective mass is the virtual processes that are being used. So it's fine.
Great, continue.
Well, I'll continue on that.
So you're saying there's a temperature sweep to get us. You do a temperature sweep to get your mass, right?
This is not low enough.
Catherine's question is not irrelevant.
Yes. How are we doing on time?
I just want to establish something here. We probably have about 15 minutes to go. How much material do you have that you think we would like to hear?
Well, that's debatable, but you certainly like to see this view graph anyway. I mean, that's I can't remember what the other ones look like, but no. So essentially, one thing that's very clear is that the Fermi surface that you see in cerium indium 3 inside the antiferromagnetic phase relates to this thing called the D sheet, which was labelled by whoever did the Bantrop calculations of lanthanum indium 3. And the 4F electrons are essentially mostly localized. And what one has in the middle of the lanthanum indium 3 Brillouin zone is this orbit, which looks something like this, with these necks coming out of it. Okay. And what one has then is, of course, Bragg reflection of the conduction electrons off the ordered F moments. And of course, the F moments are ordered with some kind of vector which looks like this, the anti-ferromagnet. This is well established by neutron scattering experiments. And these will potentially open up gaps. And in this particular case, it causes these necks to be truncated, as well as breaking up the larger sheets of Fermi surface into little small pieces. Okay? And there's a direct one-to-one correspondence between the location of these hotspots and where these necks are in lanthanum indium 3. And so, presumably, something to do with this antiferromagnetic order parameter. There's some fluctuations associated with this thing inside the antiferromagnetic phase, which are causing the mass to be enhanced at these regions where the necks have been truncated. Since once you suppress the antiferromagnetic order parameter, of course, this section of the Fermi surface here would no longer exist, because you would have the next would reappear at high fields eventually.
Why does it have anything to do with the situations of the antiferromagnetic order? If you have an antiferromagnetic order, you automatically change the
Right.
Why does it have anything to do with?
Well, where else could it come from? What else
is like? Just static order. If you have static order, you bracket flag.
The static order.
There's a static part which will produce the Bragg diffraction,
right?
Modify the topology of the Fermi surface.
And not the mass.
And then there are the zero point fluctuations of the magnetic moments around their ordered thing, which will produce a self energy, which has a real and imaginary part, which are related by Cramer's chronic.
Absolutely, but usually the fluctuations only give you lifetime effects.
No, because Cramer's chronic to give the real part.
Yeah. If you have an interferromagnet, we know that you change the velocity, right? I mean, you change the electronic structure, you change the effective mass at the hole pockets. But still, you have a Fermi liquid if you have a hole pocket.
Hole pocket? What Fermi surface are you referring to?
You
open up a mini gap.
Yes.
Now, two effects of the field. Number one, you're suppressing the antiferromagnetic order.
Yes.
And number two, the magnetic field scale can allow you to jump across a mini gap.
Yes, that's true.
So that effect, I would just naively assume that effect has to be estimated first before you can sit down.
Right, and that's
affected masses.
Right. And so magnetic breakdown is a very well-studied phenomena, and when that occurs, there is no effect on the effective mass, either in a spin density wave system, as has been measured before, or in any other system where you have, like, a Charles density wave, or etc., or even a regular metal where one has orbits crossing the zone boundary.
No, I'm trying to say, if I went up a mini gap, by definition, the velocity at the top.
Right.
This gap is zero by definition. The velocity is zero.
Well, I mean, it would always be zero in certain directions on certain bits of the Fermi surface in K-space, sure. But it's... I don't think it's... I guess you'd have to clarify exactly what you mean there, because it's not obvious to me why it should always be zero.
I'm just making a generic comment. I mean, I would assume that effect should be calculated. I mean, you take this Fermi surface,
right?
You fold it back.
Yes.
With an antiferromagnetic gap in there.
Yes.
And then you calculate the Hoffman-Alpin orbits, and you see what the effective mass comes out.
But it
works before you start worrying about any.
But this is a well-studied problem. This has been done in countless other materials. And you do have quasi-particles either going round, I would say, Bragg reflection from the antiferromagnetic order, and you modify the orbit. And in that case, of course, you'd have a modified Fermi surface topology, or you would have magnetic breakdown. And when that magnetic breakdown occurs, there is no enhancement of the mass. And this has been shown in this is very well covered in the literature.
And what exactly wasn't the fluctuations, the spin waves?
Well,
well-defined anti-ferromagnets. What is flat waves? Just spin waves?
Well, there will be spin waves there, of course.
Yeah, so that's what you have in mind?
Or fluctuations of the order parameter, the anti-ferromagnetic order parameter.
I mean, the problem is if you have spin waves and you couple them to the conduction electrons,
yes,
there's a principle which is called the Adler principle, which means that these right. fluctuations cannot destroy the Fermi liquid. So if
right.
you're sitting at the Fermi surface, you can't have a change in the mass because
right.
of bright scattering, but you cannot have a change. You cannot have a large scattering effect.
Right, right. right.
I mean, we can go, it would take a little bit longer, but I think that point needs to be kind of clarified.
Right, right. Well, I haven't really. Well, okay. I guess I haven't really seen any works which have, I would say, described the relationship between spin waves and scattering in a electron fluid. I haven't seen this. So, I don't think it's a very well covered issue.
This
so.
Could be the case. You're saying this could be.
Well, I don't know. I mean, it's one possibility, but one thing's certainly true, and that is once the antiferromagnetism is suppressed, this hotspot won't exist. You will essentially open up this Fermi surface at this point. And so this thing has to be subject to fluctuations at the quantum critical point. No, there's going to be a point where the nail temperature goes to zero, where this thing is you know, in some intermediate state between existing and not existing. And the orbit will exist on one side of the quantum critical point or phase transition, and it won't exist on the other. And that thing is subject to fluctuations. I mean, that's the picture that I have in mind. And to what extent that maps into the spin wave scattering, I don't really know. But,
yeah. Well, I suggest that you bring the talk to the conclusion.
Well, okay, so I was going to, let's see, I'm just seeing if there's something important to say on this particular, well, this is an interesting comparison. This is the Hasselhoff effect at fields of roughly 10 tesla as a function of pressure, and one sees that if one goes along the 100 orientation where one sees no field dependence, as a function of field, no field dependence on the mass, one does actually see the mass going up as a function of pressure. And one sees that regardless of the orientation as a function of pressure. So there's a clear difference between what's happening as a function of pressure and as a function of field. So in the case of pressure, there's a global enhancement of the effective mass over the entire sheet of the Fermi surface. As a function of field, it seems to be concentrated at these hotspots, which are related to the Q vector of the antiferromagnetic order.
Then where is the hotspot on the whole planet?
Well, I can show you that picture that I had before. In this particular case, one has, I can try to explain it in words. One has this Fermi surface of lanthanum-indium-3, which has these necks coming out of it. Okay. And the spherical bulk of that Fermi surface sits inside the antiferromagnetic baryon zone when you form the magnetic order. Okay, so these necks would protrude outside the antiferromagnetic baryon zone boundary. And so the natural thing to assume is that these things have become truncated as a result of frag reflection or zone folding or whatever you want to call it. So the reason why you're thinking of lines is because you're thinking of, you know, this case where you have a spherical Fermi surface cutting the Brillouin zone, but that doesn't happen in this particular case. What we have in this particular case is the antiferromagnetic Brillouin zone boundary. One has this spherical Fermi surface with bits coming out of it, which intersect the corner of the Brillouin zone boundary in the antiferromagnetic phase. And this thing essentially disappears when you form the ordered phase. But there's a difference. But I think it's related to the same thing. It's just a different Fermi surface topology. So So there are some interesting questions of, you know, whether, of course, there's any relationship between what's happening in cerium-indium-3 and terbium-rhodium-2, silicon-2. Of course, there's obviously a factor of 100 scale in field and temperature, roughly. And, or is there physics difference, or does the symmetry of the crystal have some kind of role? And, of course, this comes to a very complex question, I would say, and that is that in cerium-indium-3 as a function of pressure, one expects to have a heavy Fermi liquid at high pressures. This is the generic expectation. At high magnetic fields, we see that most of the Fermi surface, apart from these hotspots, seems to be unaware of this impending critical point. The mass doesn't seem to change that much. And in fact, one sees the magnetization starting to roll over and approach saturation. So it looks as if the F electrons up here seem to behave as if they're polarized or they're localized, essentially. And so there is a question of what happens between here and here. If you were to go to a system like cerium ruthenium to silicon, of course one can cross between these two regimes of a metamagnetic transition. And this is very well documented in cerium ruthenium to silicon. You've already heard talks about that. But of course, metamagnetism is not something that's discussed in the context of cubic materials. So there is a question, one of the interesting questions is, of course, if one has a heavy Fermi liquid which accommodates F electrons over here, and one over here that doesn't, how does the Fermi surface evolve from one to the other and be consistent with Luttinger's theorem? It's an interesting question. And essentially what one is doing is going from something like this to something like this as one crosses from two different areas of the phase diagram. As I showed you in the previous view graph, from cerium ruthenium to silicon II, this is perfectly understandable by way of metamagnetism because the magnetization undergoes abrupt changes as well, and so one can map the Fermi surface change to the large change in the magnetization. So the question then is, what would be the equivalent process in cerium indium 3? Will not like this at all, but I was essentially just trying to explain or trying to put this in the context of different scenarios. So what I have here is itinerant, localized, this is paramagnetic, antiferromagnetic. So in the conventional Hertz-Midas picture, one has what one might consider itinerant F electrons, which undergo a spin density wave. Of course, one has a quantum critical point, which could involve some transition between the spin density wave and some paramagnetic state. Now, of course, if it's not a spin density wave, if it's an RKKY-mediated local moment antiferromagnet, then of course one would have the thing crossing this region of the phase diagram, and then this would be essentially correspond to the composite fermion breakup picture. Now, in our particular case, it looks like at high magnetic fields that the F electrons seem to be localized. And at low magnetic fields, it seems to be an RKKY antiferromagnet, as far as I can tell, or as far as anyone can tell. And so in cerium indium 3, it seems to be crossing this part of the phase boundary. And so there's although here you have an antiferromagnetism resulting from a spin density wave, in this particular case, it's from an RKKY interactions. There's a direct analogy, I would say, between this situation and this situation. The difference here is that the F electrons are itinerant throughout, in this particular case are localized. So it's just to compare the sort of fugitive quantum critical points in the sort of general sort of context of quantum criticality. So this is essentially the end of my view graph. I just have a list of things that are proposing to do, different experiments, one of the obvious things would be to look at the way in which the what has been proposed to be a quantum critical point is affected by a magnetic field. high pressures, or to measure the, you know, for example, electrical transport, or the alternative thing would be to put a large pressure on, or I would say some intermediate pressure on, to see what happens as a function of magnetic field in that particular case. So that's to try to access some other parts of this line here. And another set of experiments we tried doing is some tin doping study. We haven't got very far with that yet. In fact, I've got some samples sitting back home, and that is if you dope with small amounts of tin, you can bring the nail temperature down a little bit. And there is a possibility of doing some more detailed experiments in 45 Tesla. I mean, this has not been, we haven't established yet, of course, whether this the nail temperature is brought down in a proportionate manner by the magnetic field when one dopes with tin. I mean, this is something which has not been done, but these are all experiments which are under consideration. So.
What are the prospects in this material, or having this been done, any material looking at the change in the Fermi surface using Dehaskin alpha between the heavy Fermi liquid, maybe at a very high pressure, and anti-fermionic metal at low pressure? So actually, I mean, you're looking at the Fermi surface on the anti-ferromagnet. Can you get out and look at it in the...
Well, the closest to that, well, let's see, let's just find those view graphs. Yeah, I mean, essentially that's been tackled, and I sort of went through this one very, very briefly. And this is a very recent publication that's come out from Eber Hiring and collaborators, where they've done a magnetic, a pressure dependence, and but the situation is very unclear. The blue line is what's referred to as the quantum critical point in cerium indium 3, what's been referred to as a quantum critical point in previous publications, and they do see the mass going up and the frequency change. So this is the frequency. They see the frequency changing significantly as a function of pressure, and they see the mass changing. Here it becomes very, I would say, unclear. There seems to be a lot of scatter in the data points, but they do, you know, claim to see some significant jump in the frequency occurring, certainly at T3. They also say that they see it at other pressures as well, but I don't know how to, whether to accept that or whether, of course, you know, it's a very small kink in the pressure dependence. But one thing that seems to be clear, that once you go above P3, there do seem to be perhaps some new frequencies which are not observed below P.
What are the masses of those new frequencies?
Let's see. I think they have them plotted down here somewhere. Yeah, sorry, yeah, it's not very clear from here. I think they're, yeah. I think these squares maybe are supposed to be the masses of those other orbits. So they're kind of similar to the other reflective masses. So I would have to go back and I can go back and verify that for you if you want.
So yeah. Instead of saying that these data contradict your data, you're saying that the orbits which do not cross the hotspots, the mass goes up, so you would say there is a global mass enhancement.
Yeah, in the case of the, well, I wouldn't say it's a contradiction because it's a different area of the phase diagram. The pressure dependent measurements in a very low magnetic field yield a different result, I would say. As a function of pressure, the mass seems to be globally enhanced everywhere. As a function of magnetic field, it seems to be concentrated at the hotspots. Now, exactly what that means, of course, is open to interpretation.
I have a question. How did you bring in the IKQI?
Sorry?
I didn't understand. How does the IKQI come into your data? You say you go from an anti-ferromagnet to sweep on, you increase the field, you simply polarize the fingers up, then slightly saturates. You go to polarize Fs.
Right.
Coupled from the,
you mean, how does
it? Is it still small?
How
so
does
where is IKQI? How do you see IKQI?
You're asking how does the magnetic field couple to that?
No, I'm just, you say there is transition from this polarized
yes.
Spin system to IKQI.
Right.
I don't understand.
why I use the term IKKY. Yes. It's just the model that everyone seems to believe is that it's an IKKY mediated.
Do you see any IKKY physics in your data?
No, I don't think we wouldn't be able to tell the difference between that and something else. Okay. No. No. Well, one thing that's clear, and that is, it's not a spin density wave.
Yeah.
But room temperature down, you see local moment physics in this system. That would be the simple answer.
Yeah. So we know it's not a spin density wave. And so there are only two things left, isn't there? It's either got to be RKKY mediated antiferromagnet, or there's some sort of direct exchange between the 4Fs. But, I mean, that generally is not observed in cerium 4F systems.
You don't see RKKY in your beam when it's still orbiting.
I'm sorry?
But it's the gadolinium. It's
yes.
Not RKKY system, it's still orbiting.
Right.
So it's not RKKY.
Right, but that could be a direct exchange.
Oh, okay.
In that particular case.
I don't know what it is.
Well, I'm just saying it could be. I'm not saying it is.
I think that's what's happening
here. Well, that's. I would say that's debatable. I mean, I can't give you a yes or no answer on that, but I think it's cerium indium 3 is generally considered to be consistent with the competition between RKKY and condo screening picture. It's always discussed in that context. I haven't seen anyone talk about direct exchange in cerium indium 3. So.
Any more questions? Well, Neil's around until the end of the weekend. We'll take any questions you have here up in his office, or where he's got a lot of other data as well. If you'd like to see some of the other data, he'd be happy to share it with you. Thank you.